Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a new year, and now we're going to revisit with a guest that's been on the show before who hasn't been with us for a while. I wanted to change that because this is one of my favorite people, and I would have to say one of our top-rated shows has been with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And I wanted Dr. Singleton to come back today to speak about the healthcare system. I think, as we spoke about before the show, unless you're in it as a patient or a physician, I don't think anybody really knows what's actually going on now. And today we're going to speak the truth. No hyperbole, none of this that people from on high pronounce about the healthcare system who know nothing about it. I think we need to have a conversation about where we are now. I think we can both speak to where we were, and I think we should probably start off with a conversation with that. But I think people, if you don't know, then you can't protect yourself. And Dr. Singleton is the past president of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. She is a Californian and, like myself, somebody who practiced medicine, or I should say trained, where medicine was as much of an art as it is a science, and patient care and Hippocratic Oath meant something. She trained at UCSF. She completed 2 years of surgery there and also her anesthesia residency, which she completed at Harvard Beth Israel Hospital. And she's been a teacher. She's been a practicing physician. And I think for the most part, this is somebody who understands healthcare the way it's designed, not corporate driven, but patient driven. So Dr. Singleton, I want to thank you so much for joining me today because I miss you and I'm glad we got a chance, or we are getting a chance, to reconnect.
Well, Dr. George, it is so good to be here. It has been too long.
I know. It's terrible, but we're going to fix that. So our conversation today is about us, about physicians. Have you noticed that over the past 3 years, everybody seems to be a physician? They know everything about healthcare, and they've literally turned it on its head. We've had an influx of ancillary practitioners. We've had the elevation of people who aren't physicians becoming the front line of care. And I know we're going to have a conversation about that, but I wanted to start off the beginning. You've taught medical students. When I went to medical school and I took my oath, Hippocratic Oath really was the baseline, the foundation of how I approach healthcare. Tell me about, from your standpoint, you were actually quite a pioneer. How did the Hippocratic Oath start for you, and what does it mean to you as a physician?
To start off, the Hippocratic Oath, or I like to say the Oath of Hippocrates, was put patients first. Everything was about the patient. And I must say, it's almost amusing every time I hear it, that there's nothing in the Hippocratic Oath that says first do no harm. Somehow that sort of got to be there, but that came much, much later and somebody else wrote that. But he did say that you would never do anything to hurt the patient. You would treat all patients the same, whether free or slave, meaning everybody's treated the same, not this nonsense that they're doing now, favoring different groups or the other. That if you treat everybody the same, you don't need to favor certain groups over the other. And it, the, and one of the things he said, that you kept the patient's confidences, he called them holy secrets. And that's just been blown out of the water, not only with what these newer students are thinking, because they're brought up in the age of electronic medical records and everybody knowing everything about everybody else, because we all know HIPAA is kind of a joke, that it doesn't really protect any information. And so the students are used to the information being out there, it's on the internet. And in my day, it's one of the reasons we always say the patient, because You make sure you didn't use people's names when you were talking about them publicly. It wasn't to be aloof. It was to make sure that nobody knew the patient's name. So it really embodied the concept of patient first. And that just doesn't seem to be what's happening now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you say, you talk about the healthcare system. I think one of the interesting things is we don't really want it to be a system. When we think about bureaucracies and other systems, the DMV, the post office, whatever, you realize that no, that's not how you want your health care to be, your medical care. You want it to be something personal. And I know you feel that way too.
Absolutely. And you make a really excellent point. We went from individualized care to evidence-based medicine. To me, that was the beginning of the end, where some actuary, or worse yet, some pharmaceutical company got to run the trials, got to run these experiments, and then pronounce that their drug should be the standard of care. And it became really pharmaceutical-based, more than practicing medicine, having their own individual success stories. That got completely pushed out by the wayside. Do you think that that beginning was, well, is always my mantra is always follow the money. But was it the fact that all of these healthcare education, the big pharma came in with big money to the academic institutions, and that changed the complexion of it?
Well, I think so. It's very interesting. I remember early on when open heart surgery was changing to where many of the things that were done with open heart surgery, you found out you could treat with drugs. You might not necessarily need a heart bypass, that maybe drugs called beta blockers might give you the same lifespan. And we were very proud and pleased that, oh boy, drugs could save somebody from surgery. But then at some point, it got out of hand. And as you point out, it's like the pharmaceutical companies are ruling what good medicine is. I'm not a cardiologist, but I understand on some of the cardiology tests, the right answer is always a drug. But we know in real life, that's not necessarily true. And more things are coming out now. I think, you know, what's that expression in the movies that they jump the shark mm-hmm. when they have a drug for absolutely everything? You see the ads on TV for things that most people don't even have. And people, I think, are starting to get wise to it. And looking for other alternatives.
I agree. I hope they are, because we're on an unsustainable path. There's so many medications on the market. You certainly can't turn on the news without seeing a big pharma commercial backing it up, or sporting events being underwritten by pharmaceutical companies. And that's supposed to be one of the healthier things, right? You're working out, you're watching athletes at the top of their peak health. And you've got big pharma underwriting these sporting events. It's kind of ironic in a way. And we're going to take a break in a minute, but I want to start off the return question with, how did we get here? How did the doctors who are in practice let this happen? So on that note, let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And you can go to her website, MarilynSingletonDJD.com, and you can read her blogs. You can also learn more about her. She's got a lot to say, not only about healthcare, but about our society, about medical ethics, about politics. I think in this day and age, you have to be a Renaissance person. You can't just stick your head in the sand and hope for the best. Now, prior to the break, we were speaking about, I think, the underpinnings of our healthcare system. My next question is, how did we get here? I recall when I was in training as a medical student, one of the doctors said to me, you know, when it's 50% women, it's going to be a completely different system. You won't make as much money. It'll just be not what it is now. And we kind of poo-pooed him, but something did happen with our healthcare system in the span of my finishing my training to date. How do you think doctors have let this get to this point?
It's interesting you bring up the women thing. I was training in San Francisco at the end of the Vietnam War. And so a lot of men came back from the Vietnam War who'd been medics, and they became nurses. And amazingly, at that same time, nurses' salaries went up. So you get men into nursing, the salaries go up. Concomitantly, when women went into medicine, salaries went down. You know, kind of an interesting little sociological issue. You know, it's something you mentioned. You can't just, we're talking about medicine, but medicine isn't in a vacuum, that it's part of the bigger culture. But one of the things that I have seen, and why doctors have really just sort of become apathetic about the politics of medicine, is time. There used to be a time when you could spend time with the patient. And even in my specialty, anesthesia, before they started having outpatient surgery, which is a wonderful thing, I'm not knocking outpatient surgery, that you used to go in the patient's room the night before you do a pre-op visit. So it was like a regular visit. You went in their room, you introduce yourself, talk to them, and you could talk to them for 15, 20 minutes or longer if it was a really big case. Well, with outpatient surgery, it was kind of this treat them and street them. You just sort of go in, introduce yourself, because a nurse took the history 2 days before. You'd read the history, talk to the patient, and they're saying, come on, they're turning over the room. You have to get in there. So the relationship with the patient is 5 minutes before they go to sleep. And then it became the same way in internist's office. When they started having these systems where these big hospital groups bought up the medical practices, visits, and people have gone to the doctor, no, it's not an exaggeration. Some visits are 7 minutes long that you have with the doctor. You might be there longer, but if you actually look at your watch for the time that you spent with the doctor, it's 7 minutes. And if the doctors are cranking patients through like that, then at the end of the day, have to go fill out the electronic medical records, when do they have time to really think about what they're doing? You would think if you were being pushed that hard, you'd be like, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. But instead, I'm tired as hell and I'm just going to go to sleep.
You know, we're one of an interesting group, I think, as physicians, aren't we? We're the people in the class that followed orders, you know, did well in class, worked hard, and basically followed every little hurdle that we were put through in order to get to where we are. Do you think that training made us more susceptible to just taking it?
Well, somewhat, but on the other hand, you look at doctors and the famous speech by the surgeon in Atlas Shrugged, where he's talking about, do you want somebody who just falls back and listens to everything, or do you want somebody who's strong and can think for themselves? And of course, you want somebody strong who can think for themselves. And that certainly is the kind of folks that would go into medicine. And I wonder, with in the 90s, when tech became very popular and more engineering-directed professions came more popular, whether those people who wanted to think for themselves and were very driven went into those professions rather than medicine. And then medicine started getting people who were more social work minded. And again, I think a lot, doctor, you're kind of part social worker, but you're not all social worker. And so I don't know, the mentality of going into medicine should still be the same. You're there, you're all for the patient, but you're a scientist too, not just somebody to be kind of touchy-feely with the patient. and nothing else. So I think it's a complicated thing. And in the meantime, we look at how society has changed and with so many things for the better, but then a lot of things for the worse. I remember, well, years ago when some of the medical schools stopped teaching anatomy on cadavers, you know, formerly living human beings, that it was all done with computer animation. And I think little things like that become a turning point where when we had our cadaver, there were four of us that shared our cadaver. You looked at this. This was a human being, and you felt very close to, even though it was not a living human being, it gave you some sense of humanity. And then fast forward to learning anatomy off of computer animation. That takes you one step away from the body, from the humanness. And it's little things like that. You know, nobody's going to sit there and say, oh, I'm doing computer animation. This isn't a human. But that's the sort of thing. They're like subliminal messages. And after a while, they kind of get to you and become incorporated in the way you deal with people.
I think that's an outstanding point. I never even thought of that. You know, we honored our cadaver, the person that we had as our, the person that we dissected. It was, you had a sense of who that person was. It also put you in the mindset of, you know, this is somebody who gave themselves to science. It's my job to honor it and to pay attention. And you're making a really important statement, but I want to make a real world statement based on what you just said. There are doctors, surgeons now coming out who need to be proctored because they haven't done any surgeries. They don't understand anatomy. They can't get out and do cases. That's not, I mean, we did 1,000 cases before we graduated. You did 2 years of surgery. So I know you know your anatomy. You can't just come out and know this, you know, down the road. You actually have to be, you know, it's a practice, isn't it? It's not just learning something by computer animation. You actually have to put your hands on it. You have to think about it. It has to be a critical thinking aspect to healthcare, to medicine, that is gone now.
Well, that's right. And one of the things, it's you start to get a feel for it. And it's something that's hard to put your finger on. And if everything has become so mechanized, I mean, look at this artificial intelligence. Again, some of the things that are wonderful, apparently artificial intelligence can read x-rays in some cases better than a human eye because the computer scans the x-ray and looks for something abnormal. But as many women know who've had a callback, including myself, for a mammogram because they're overread, then you have to get a different kind of mammogram. And then the radiologist looks at it and says, no, this isn't a tumor. So, and they have the computer for years, they've had computers read EKGs and they tend to overread the EKGs. So there was always the doctor that then looked at it and said, oh no, that's overread. But some of these medical students, I've heard them say, oh, I like the algorithms. Then I don't have to think. I cringed when I heard.
Oh my gosh. Somebody said that. Oh, wow.
And that's the problem. It's an additive. It's a help to you, but it's not a replacement.
No. But it's become the standard, hasn't it? So somehow this has been turned on its head where the human is the fallible person or the thing that gums up the system when in actuality, we're probably getting more tests, more things done based on somebody not paying attention and not being the first line of patient care. It's like they've used the least experienced and supplement it with AI as if it's equal to a human being. But, you know, I had a show a week ago and I said, and I still believe this, there's no way AI can outdo a human being. It's programmed by a human being with all of our foibles. So how on earth can it be perfect?
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And people tend to forget that unless they're kind of in computers, you know, the old garbage in, garbage out. And it's not knocking the advances. My goodness, some of the things I think about, you know, ultrasound and some of the prenatal things that have come up. I'm, you know, they're wonderful advances in medicine. You know, it certainly gives away my age, but when I was an intern, they didn't have CAT scans. So when people came in with head trauma, you can't really see everything on a skull film. It doesn't really show very much. You can see a big fractured skull, but you can't always see subdural or epidural hematomas. So the way that we would diagnose it, you take the patient to the operating room and put a drill in their head and do something called a burr hole. And it's just like taking a regular drill. And when you were an intern, you had to use the hand crank drill. They didn't trust you with the electric one. And then, you know, after you did a few, then you could use the electric drill and see if blood spurted out. There were certain spots in the skull that you drilled. That's how you did a diagnosis. Well, hallelujah. Isn't it great that they have CAT scans now? So we're not Luddites. We don't want to stay in the dark ages, but there's still that humanity that has to be in medicine. And that's what all the mechanistic ways and the systems and now private equity buying doctors' offices, it strips away a little of that humanity. And if a person didn't already train in an era where the patient is the primary concern, not what the bean counter at Sutter's going to say when you order too many tests or whatever, they're just going to get more mechanistic. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only beat a dog so much before they say, woof, woof, yes, master, I'll do whatever you say.
Agreed. Well, let's take our second break because I want to talk more about this administrative overlay. It's become extremely powerful. And I think you're right. It takes away the humanity and it also makes everybody a cost center. So let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And before the break, we were talking about our healthcare system in a way that from the doctor perspective, a human side of it. But there's this administrative beast that's grown into the healthcare system. I remember, I don't know how long ago, maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little longer, they were talking about the ratio of administrators to doctors in the hospital. And it was some crazy number. I think it was something like 12 to 1, but it's definitely more of them than it is physicians. And they're a huge cost center in the hospital. They make a boatload of money, but they don't add to patient care, but they end up affecting how doctors do their jobs. Now, I've not been part of the academic side where I'm a teaching hospital. I'm an instructor. I mean, you were a professor of anesthesiology and critical care at Johns Hopkins. Do you remember was there a change with the administrators becoming more powerful?
Well, it's very interesting because at the time when I did that, the departments ruled their own roost. I mean, there were certain rules and things that you did that were within that hospital system. And I remember various insurance rules were coming in as far as how many cases could be done at once and all this sort of thing. But we felt our department was still in charge. And then you fast forward to now, where even in private practice, if you're in one of the hospitals that has a system, I remember we couldn't get all the drugs we wanted. It wasn't because there was a shortage, but there were certain drugs that we thought were better. But the hospital system said, no, we're not going to buy those. Those are too expensive. And of course, there were always a few vials of the perfect drug around just in case. But yeah, you've got to look at price. But if you're trying to give the perfect anesthetic or do the perfect surgery, there were certain surgery packs surgeons wanted, and they said, well, no, now we're only using this surgery pack. And it's like, you know, grow up, learn to use what we're giving you. That's sort of hard to take. And you can say, well, maybe we were big babies and we should learn to use what they give us. But, you know, are we going to get a pocket knife next instead of a scalpel?
It is about the bottom line. But that was the beginning of that power shift, right? It was the economic bottom line and not what the doctor wanted for patient care. And, you know, would it have been a change had doctors just said, we're not doing this and we're done, we're leaving? Could that have been more of a barrier against this? Instead of saying, okay, I'm out, I'll take another, just say, I'm not doing it. Walk away. Go back to private practice.
Well, this is the interesting thing. One, obviously, you can't abandon your patient. And two, this is, again, where medicine isn't in a vacuum, that if you were a doctor with a family, you got married in medical school, had a couple of kids, $300,000 worth of debt, and you say, okay, my family comes first, I can't walk away. I mean, you know, you looking at the whole picture for some people, some mm-hmm. people can walk away, some people did walk away, and it's unfortunate that more people didn't. I remember this was probably 1974. That was during the California malpractice insurance crisis, when malpractice insurance rates, more than quintupled for certain specialties. It went from $10,000 a year to $60,000 a year. I mean, that's a huge number. Imagine how much money somebody would have to make to pay $60,000 a year just to be able to practice medicine. So the anesthesiologists went on strike, and it was a big kind of moral crisis for people. You don't want to make things bad for patients, but on the other hand, how it ultimately makes things bad for patients, because you have to raise the prices to come up with $60,000 a year just to practice medicine. And it didn't last long. They got the picture. And in fact, Jerry Brown, it was under his governorship that they had what was called the micro law, which changed the malpractice laws, where they had limits on pain and suffering, statute of limitations, doctors having to review the case to get rid of frivolous suits. You couldn't double dip, like if the insurance paid you for whatever your problems were, you couldn't double dip against the doctor too. So the malpractice insurance prices just plummeted. And so the strike worked. So everybody got together. And again, you end up having to look at the whole picture, because initially you think, well, this is bad. I'm going to hurt patients if I don't go to work. But on the other hand, if you think about it, in the long run, patients are hurt more if you don't stand up and say, no, this isn't right. And you're not saving money off of my patient's back. Look mm-hmm. for other ways to save money. And there are. When I was at Hopkins, we had this thing. It was actually kind of cute. It was called the Idea Bank. And because they were looking for ways to save money, none of which had anything to do with compromising patient care. But if you submitted an idea and they used it, you got this cup with a light bulb on it that said, I'm not just drinking, I'm thinking. And but there were a lot of ways that people came up with to save money. And I think the easy way out, of course, is saying, well, we'll just use a cheaper drug, or we'll have shorter visits and crank in more patients. Mm-hmm. And, you know, instead of having people sit down and actually be very creative about ways to save money.
Well, you know, why can't, well, for the most part, it seems like a lot of our healthcare response, our how we treated patients, didn't need to be changed. I mean, the only thing that they managed to do is try to cheapen everything. It's like the money got shifted from the person who was providing the service to the system, to the hospital, to the clinical group, or whatever. It just went away from the person who was actually providing the service. And then in order to compensate for that, that uptick in or that lowering of the fees, people had to start seeing more people. I remember I was practicing, or I should say I was in medical school before physician assistants came about. And it just seemed like an explosion as soon as capitation came in. Instead of just paying people what they were worth, they did everything they possibly could to cheapen, you know, our delivery. But someone is still making money on that, whether it's the insurance companies and these premiums where they don't pay out, or the hospitals because they get paid more than a private practice doctor. There just seems to be this pot that it's opaque. It's making a lot of money. It's boosting the cost of healthcare, but the delivery's just going south. How do we alert patients to that? What's your thought on that?
Well, it's very interesting when you look at this Hospital Price Transparency Act that was supposed to be the be-all and end-all, and oh boy, hospitals have to tell their prices. Well, of course, it's not transparent. No one can understand the prices. They have something called chargemaster prices. It's kind of like you go to the department store and the dresses are marked one thing. You go across the street to the rack where the same dress is probably one third less, that the price at the main department store is what the charge master is in the hospital, where it's not really the cost of anything. It's a made up price for a product. And then they negotiate with the insurance companies from that number down. And the patient still doesn't know, because if they have insurance, they don't know what the contract or the deal is that the hospital made with the insurance company. So showing somebody the charge master price is meaningless. The biggest thing that, oh, since we're thinking about these prices, that I can say to patients is, don't take the amount of money that they've charged you, particularly if you're a cash paying patient, don't accept it. Say, wait a minute, this is what I'm willing to pay. And amazingly, the hospitals will bargain. Sometimes you're better off being a cash patient than you are having insurance, because then you're stuck with whatever the insurance company bargained. And as people who've had a big expense know, remember, if you have a 20% copay, it matters what the cost is. 20% of $1,000 is a lot different than 20% of $10,000. So what the insurance company negotiated does matter. And unfortunately, the patients aren't part of that negotiation. They're just the hapless fools that are stuck with the bill that the insurance company won't pay.
You're absolutely right. It's maddening, really, that they can get away with these facility fees, and they already own the equipment. Let's look at radiology, for example. You know, you own your CAT scan by this point, but they're charging a facility fee plus the doctor reading the, actually they get the least, the radiologist reading the report. Everything else is just making out like a bandit. But again, the person who's doing the actual work is getting the least of this pie. What is it, like 7 cents on the dollar that the doctor actually makes compared to all of the other ancillary pieces of the healthcare system, administrators and you name it, the insurance companies, et cetera. You're absolutely right about that transparency bill. It really wasn't what it was cracked up to be. I would have loved to have really seen or had it be equal, you know, between hospitals and doctors. What we ended up doing is moving towards and I don't, I'm going to take a break, but the out of network, they're trying to get rid of the out of network charge and make it equal to the in network charge. Everything right. they could do to just put all the power in the corporate system, ace out anybody who really is for the patient in terms of their care and in terms of keeping their money in their pocket in a reasonable amount of money, in a reasonable way. They've just been trying, they try to remove us from the system. Let's take our last break because I want to get your take on that out of network thing when we come back. You're living okay. in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. Again, we're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and her website is MarilynSingletonMDJD.com. I was mistaken before. And before the break, we were talking about this money that's being charged in this system. Do you find that it's just been a lot of talk and window dressing, but all the power seems to be still moving towards concentrating it towards large hospitals, this hospital corporate entity that just seems to be Pac-Manning rural hospitals, et cetera. And it, by taking out, let's say, the out-of-network benefit where patients would have some power to see who they wanted, if they actually kept it all the same price as, like, not pay it at all for out-network or make the out-network doctor take the loud amount for in-network, is that a chilling effect on private patient care?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a reason somebody's out of network. They didn't want to have to be held to the terms of the contract. If they wanted the contract, then they'd be in network. And there's certainly advantages to going to people who are out of network. Sometimes they have a particular specialty. I would say to people who, if your five-year-old daughter went to the ER, she had a dog bite, she had this scar on her cheek or, you know, a bite on her cheek. Who do you want sewing it up? A plastic surgeon or the physician's assistant? Well, in these hospital systems, they'll give you a physician's assistant unless you make a stink and say, no, I want a plastic surgeon. And then, oh, well, we don't have any in network. Well, darn it, you need to tell them, treat my daughter the same way you would want your daughter treated. I tell patients when, if they have cancer and anybody tries to skimp on you, say, I want the same treatment that Jimmy Carter got at 95 years old for his melanoma. You know, I'm only 50. I deserve at least what he got. And just remind them that you aren't chopped liver. You're a person and you deserve the best. And so they're using money as the cudgel to really try to make those out-of-network doctors just say, well, I might as well be in network and then join the network. But then there's other restrictions. When you're in network, you have drug formulary restrictions. And again, most of the time, substitute drugs work as well as whatever drug was on your mind that you wanted to give the patient. But not always. Thyroid medication is an example where the generic's different from the brand name, and different brand names are different from each other. And there are several other drugs that are that way. And you don't want to have to get in a big letter writing fight and go back and forth, sometimes taking weeks to prove your point. Meanwhile, what happens to the patient? I mean, a lot of times that's one of the reasons the doctors will lower themselves to take the samples from the drug company, because you want a sample on hand while you're arguing with the healthcare system to approve the drug that you want to give the patient. So it's not just that one particular treatment that you're giving on that particular day that you're out of network, but there's a whole nother set of rules that you don't necessarily want to have to follow.
I absolutely agree. Or this arbitrary nature of these insurance companies calling something experimental that's allowed, that's well known within the specific specialty. You know, they just decide they don't want to pay for it and they just have a big catch-all of experimental, investigational, when it has ample evidence that it works. Or my favorite, it's cheaper. You know, you can do procedures that are much more cost effective than going into a hospital setting. And the insurance company denies you. I mean, are they trying to save money? Apparently they're not, really. So this must be a bigger picture of this connection between the pharmacy benefit management companies, hospitals, the formulary. Now we have the pharmacies also taking their little piece, because we have what some of these insurance companies are connected with various pharmacies. What happened to, I don't know, not restriction of trade,
but antitrust.
Thank you. Is this like collusion or something? How is this legal?
I know this is, and it's called vertical integration, where you own everything from the bottom up, and Aetna and CVS is like that. So Aetna insurance, and then you have to go to CVS to get the drugs in order to get the rate. And now CVS has these clinics. So you go to the CVS clinic, you have Aetna insurance, you get the CVS drugs. So CVS gets all the money. They're a long way from when they bought a couple of Long's drugstores. And more and more of these systems are like that. So they're not just doing one thing. They have you from soup to nuts. And you can't go outside that system, or else it's going to cost you big bucks. So if you have the Aetna insurance, if you don't go to CVS, your drug can cost up to five times as much. So they've got you coming and going. And one of the things with these big systems, I notice it just because I trained in Boston and I was at Beth Israel when it was Beth Israel. And now it's Beth Israel Deaconess. And it was interesting because it was two different mindsets. Deaconess was Catholic and they didn't do abortions, and Beth Israel did abortions. And there's different mindset at Deaconess than there was at Beth Israel, you know, in that regard. And Beth Israel kind of had its own, if you want to use the word, culture, and is very proud of its Jewish heritage. And I haven't been there since they merged, and I thought, must be very interesting. And then you have Peter Bent Brigham, that's now Brigham and Mass General. And each of those hospitals had their own culture. And it's just interesting to me, as they all merge together, really the patient doesn't have as much choice, because somebody might say, oh, I like BI. I, you know, I like their attitudes there. I like Deaconess. Well, now they're all the same. So it's, you know, it's going to be one giant hospital with the same administrator at the top, giving the same rules. And it really kind of bothersome.
I can speak to that in New York. I mean, there were, what, seven or eight different hospitals in New York, in city alone. They're all connected. You know, they're been just melded into one. And that's the good thing about when they were independent, there was a different culture. You know, Lenox Hill was tiny. It was like a community hospital. That's where I did my general surgery. Now it's part of, I don't know, North Shore. It's completely different. Not only from the training standpoint, but from the patient care standpoint. I really love the kind of the community base. You've said hello to everybody. There was the janitor or a surgeon you were working with, and now it's just a monolith. That's, to me, strips out the humanity of healthcare. And that's the art of being a physician. It's being able to look at somebody as an individual, not as the next one in the conveyor belt. You know, I didn't see 30 people a day. In our clinic, we didn't even see that many people, because you had time to actually learn and interact. You know, it seems to me it's not only doctors who've been affected by this, it's also nurses. We trained with nurses. They were amazing. And we learned really a lot of patient care from interacting with senior RNs. They've been decimated as well, right? They've got nursing assistants and techs and all these other things, that the same thing that came in with doctors, same thing with pharmacists, right? There's pharmacy techs. Do you think that, I mean, I think the pendulum is swinging, that people, I think doctors are, should say, hospitals are figuring out maybe it's not so cost effective to have all of the frontline care given by people with less experience, and it costs more. more tests are done unnecessarily. I mean, I'm an ENT. You shouldn't have to do a CT scan for a peritonsillar abscess. It's a clinical diagnosis. But that happened all the time when I was working as a locums, as a contract labor. That's unnecessary. Can imagine how much that goes on. You know, calling consults for earwax on a hospital. How much money is that for a patient when you can just get an otoscope? You know, it's just, I mean, I wouldn't even call it laziness. I don't think people know. And so the patient is the one that takes the brunt of that.
Well, that's right. I don't think people know. There's something to having seen a lot of patients, done a lot of rotations at multiple different hospitals, all the things you do in the residency. And then when you're out in the world, the more patients you see, kind of the smarter you get. And you see a broad group of patients. A lot of times with the advanced practice groups, like there's an orthopedic physician's assistant, you know, a physician's assistant for this, that, or the other. And if there's something a little different than the usual thing that they do, they have to order the tests because they don't know. And I now they do have the studies of some of the advanced practice doesn't save money because more tests are ordered to validate, you know, maybe it was a thought, but if you were a physician who'd seen a lot of this before, that you wouldn't necessarily get the test. You know the diagnosis and take care of it lickety split. So we all know that we need everybody who's in the healthcare system, you know, all levels of people, but shifting of these duties and responsibilities, what they're trying to do is make the doctor like some sort of a circus ringmaster, and you have one doctor, and as they used to say in the old days, in a stable of nurses and PAs, and that's not how it should be, that you know, things should be spread out pretty equally. And some people prefer to go to a nurse practitioner that they might have a relationship or feel that the nurse practitioner is a better listener, whatever. Patients should have that choice. That's fine. But definitely don't say that it's the same as going to the doctor.
I think that's an excellent place to stop because you're absolutely right. Everybody's an MD now. Everybody's a doctor. They don't say what of, but patients also, we probably have to have a conversation about patients being a lot more savvy and not just taking it. We talked on this segment about how we got to where we are. The patients also have responsibility as to what's happened to them too. And I'm looking forward to our next conversation because I think we can talk about the economics of our health. We just touched on it. But there's a lot of money that's being used against patients and doctors. I want to explore that. But I think the next segment probably be talking about what the patients, how they got to their point and what they can do about it. So in the last seconds we have, I know you have a show. How can people listen to you?
Okay, I have a show, which of course you'd better agree to come on yourself. We'll do
you
a
bet.
Little exchange here.
It's you
called
got it.
America Out Loud Pulse. And this is a show focused on medicine, and it's five different doctors, Monday through Friday. And it's americaoutloud.com/pulse. And I'm on Mondays, but everything goes to podcasts. So you can hear it any day of the week. And people talk about COVID. People talk about all sorts of things, anything medical and cultural as well. So hope you'll give it a listen.
I know I will. I'm looking forward to coming on, and I'm also looking forward to having you back. So I want to thank you for your time. I know how busy you are.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk Events.